Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It seems I just saw you. But thank you very much for getting up early to come to an early presentation on political economy in the light of history. Before I begin my lecture today about World War II, I want to say a little more about the Great Depression and the policies adopted by especially the Roosevelt administration to respond to political pressures that arose as a result of that depression. And to say a little bit about some of the important consequences of what was done during the 1930s. I have not mentioned so far, there are far too many things even to list, so I have to be very selective in discussing what was done by Roosevelt and his comrades, but I certainly must say a little about the passage of legislation in 1935 to create the Social Security system. Before that time, the Americans had done relatively little to follow the lead of the Western European countries, beginning with Bismarck in Germany in the 1880s to create various forms of government insurance against misfortune, either illness or injury, inability to work, or inability to earn income in old age, so that the Germans set an example. Bismarck, of course, was a conservative. He was not creating these government benefits because he was driven to do something for the masses. Indeed, this was a defensive measure. German socialists were becoming stronger by 1880, and so Bismarck, in order to protect the government from socialist pressures, understood that perhaps he could buy them off. He could create these social benefits through government and diminish their desire for revolution. And it appears that he was correct and that he succeeded. There were, of course, still many German socialists, but they never reached the point where they seriously attempted to overthrow the German state. And when the war began, of course, they revealed that their loyalties to the state were greater than their loyalties to socialist ideals. Socialists thought that it was a capitalist trick to go to war against their comrades in other countries who were being exploited in the same way that they were by other rulers, but people demonstrated in 1914 that their nationalism was deeper than their socialism. So the socialists of France joined the armies of France, and the socialists of Germany and Austria joined the armies of Austria, and they proceeded to kill one another. But Bismarck began something that was very important for the economic history of the past 125 years in Europe and other parts of the world too, because this system of government social insurance and protections against various forms of economic misfortune have spread widely. The United States had some activity of this kind at the state level. There was insurance at the state level beginning in the early 20th century. During the Progressive Era, one of the progressive measures was a form of insurance called workers' compensation. And this was a way of guaranteeing that workers who were injured on the job would have some kind of payment to compensate them for their injuries and to help give them income when they were unable to work. But except for workers' compensation and for some payments local governments made to people who were completely misfortunate, completely unable to care for themselves, people such as orphans or women who had children but had no husband, perhaps their husband had died. Local governments would take care of these people who were destitute, who had no way to support themselves. So that was always done in America for centuries. There was nothing unusual. This system was brought over from the English system of poor relief, the English called it. And so many Europeans think that the Americans are very hard-hearted, that they have no sympathy for those who are suffering. This is a myth. It's not true. We're not wicked. But Americans did believe, for the most part, that responsibility for caring for the poor and for the those who had misfortune belonged to voluntary groups and to neighbors, friends, people in the church, people in private organizations such as the social organizations. Fraternal groups were very popular in America, groups of people who just joined to have social life and to help one another in misfortune. So they would provide privately to take care of people who could not work, who were injured, to take care of the survivors when men were killed on the job. Some jobs in old times were dangerous. As mining, for example, was a job where men were sometimes killed at work. So, and railroad work was dangerous. Sometimes even factory work could cause serious injury or death. But when those things happened, people looked to their neighbors, their friends, their relatives. They did not look to the government, except for those who were completely without anyone to take care of them. Of course, these Bismarckian ideas, these European ideas that were copied fairly quickly in France and Great Britain and other countries to have the central government provide social insurance, Americans knew about them. And especially the American intellectuals knew about them because before the First World War, many American economists and other intellectuals studied in Europe. It was very common, especially for young men who were seeking their PhD degree to come to Germany and to go to Heidelberg or Berlin or some other German university and absorb the German teaching. And the German teaching was very statist, very socialistic leaning, very much Hegelian, in love with the state, looking to the state as the ultimate expression of social life. And so Americans brought some of those teachings back, and they spread slowly because those were not consistent with most Americans' thinking, but they began to have an effect eventually. Well, during the Great Depression, when so many new things were being done by the government created a social security system similar to those in Europe. It provided for a system of unemployment benefits. That was a system administered jointly by the state governments and the federal government, but the federal government created the system in such a way the states could not really refuse. If they did, they were heavily penalized with a tax. So all the states joined the system, and this unemployment system has existed ever since then. There was a system also of payments to the blind and to widows and orphans and such people, very low-income people. And perhaps most important of all, there was a system of old age pensions, which were payments made to persons from age 65 on. And those were supposed to be, in the beginning, a kind of insurance payout. People had to pay a tax on their earnings. In the beginning, it was a small tax. It was only 2% of their earnings. But when they reached age 65, then they would receive monthly payments from the government as long as they lived. And those payments would vary depending on how much people had paid into the system. But very soon, the nature of the system was changed so that instead of being a system which tied one's benefits to how much one had paid into the system, that relationship was loosened very much so that the system worked in such a way that, especially for low-income people, they received almost as much as people who had paid a great deal into the system in taxes. It was like a kind of progressive taxation, in a way, associated with the Social Security benefits. So it became quickly not a true insurance system, but what we call a pay-as-you-go system of old-age benefits, similar to the ones in the Western European countries. It never became quite as generous as, for example, the German system, but nonetheless, it is a system that pays out benefits according to one's age, regardless of one's need or one's income. So that if Bill Gates reaches age 65, he can collect his Social Security benefits just as a poor man can. And in that way, it's not correct to call it a welfare system. It's not really a system to take care of the poor, although it does work a little more in favor of the poor than in favor of the wealthy. But that was important because now in the United States, as in Western Europe, this system has been made so much more generous over the past 60 years that it's now no longer viable economically. If you project into the future a continuation of the existing system, what happens is that the required payout is much greater than the system will be able to pay. And that's especially true as the age composition changes. When birth rates decline, the age composition of a population adjusts so that people become older and older on the average. And what that means is that those older people receiving benefits become a larger part of the population. The younger people who are paying tax into the system, which is the source from which payments are made out, become fewer. And so unless the tax rate is increased more and more, the system is not able to survive. And the tax rates are already quite high. I said they started at 2%. Well, now they're more than 15% in the United States. And in Western Europe, of course, they're even more in many countries. So the tax rates are already very high. There's a limit on how much you can take away from workers. Not only will they mount political resistance if too much is taken away from them, but it's simply not a way that you can continue forever as the age composition changes. So all of these systems were what Americans call a Ponzi scheme, a kind of a con game, a trick, the sort of thing that works as long as you keep getting new people joining the system. But as soon as you no longer have new people joining the system and you have larger and larger numbers of people taking out the payout, then the system is no longer viable for very long. So this was done. It's been operated now for 70 years. The American people love it, of course, just as the Europeans love it, because it looks like something for nothing. That's what we all want, isn't it? Something for nothing. And for many people, it is. But politically, it must be changed eventually. And probably in Western Europe and the United States, unless this system is substantially changed in the next 20 years, there will be a disaster of some kind fiscally. So that was one thing that was done. Another thing I must mention is that as soon as Roosevelt took office, besides closing the banks, he used his powers from the legislation passed in World War I, something called the Trading with the Enemy Act that I spoke about before. And he used that power, which was still in existence, to regulate international financial transactions. And he began to move the country away from the gold standard. And in a little more than a year, the government took over the gold. It nationalized all the gold holdings. It required everybody to bring gold coins, if they had them, and surrender them to the government in exchange for paper money. It required everybody who used gold for international transactions to get a license from the United States Treasury. And so the gold standard was eliminated. And even though the Federal Reserve System still had a rule for its own activities that tied its credit to its gold holdings, that link itself was eventually completely eliminated. And so starting with 1933, the United States moved permanently away from the gold standard or any link between gold and currency, and that meant that we were completely on a fiat paper currency standard, meaning, you know, fiat currency being just paper that's on faith. It's issued by the government, and if people think it will be accepted by someone else, then they use it, they exchange it, but when they lose their faith in it, it loses all its value because it cannot be exchanged for any commodity. So that had an interesting effect. Once the monetary system was no longer restrained by the necessity of holding gold, there was nothing to discipline the Federal Reserve System from issuing more credit, increasing commercial bank reserves, and therefore allowing the whole money stock to increase through the operation of the commercial banking system. And therefore, the paper money began to lose value fairly steadily. Almost every year, in fact, it lost some value, sometimes only a little, sometimes more. If we look at the long period from the beginning of the 19th century and look at the price level, the level of overall prices, what we see is that there are some ups and downs. Here, during the Second War with England, the government also sort of issued a lot of paper money, and there's a little jump in prices here. I mean, it seemed like a lot at the time. Prices maybe doubled. But they came back after the war because the government once again observed the gold standard. And during the war between the states, we know the states and the national government issued paper money again. They interfered with the gold standard. And again, there was inflation. In the northern states, the The prices doubled approximately during the war. In the Confederate States, so much paper money was issued that the price level went up by almost 100 times as the money became worthless. It was so worthless that people no longer used it. They returned to barter, exchanging goods for goods, the most inefficient possible way to conduct economic transactions. That, by the way, was one of the reasons why the Confederate States lost the war. They hurt themselves. But they didn't have a good alternative because they couldn't borrow. And besides issuing paper money, all they could do was just take things, take men, draft men, take goods. And they did that, but that wasn't a good system either. But after the war, prices came down again. And you know, they come and go, but look how steady they are in the long run here. Now, when we get past the creation of the Federal Reserve System here, we have first World War I, and then prices fall afterwards. It looks like the old pattern, but it isn't. It isn't really. They don't fall so much. There's a deflation during the beginning of the 1930s because of the Depression, but from that time on, monetary management is inflationary. The Federal Reserve policies are always policies consistent with lower and lower value of the dollar. And that is to say, higher and higher money prices for goods in general. So we see almost never any deflation after 1933. I've sort of mistakenly put some in there. I shouldn't have put any after World War II, because prices did not really come down after World War II. They kind of went like that. And you see, in a long-term view, the price level is now 15 or 20 times greater than it was on average for more than a century. That's a product of modern monetary management. Now notice that this is the U.S. dollar, one of the best currencies in the world. If you look at most other currencies, it's even worse because of the same action by governments. Issuance of so much money that the value of the money steadily falls. But issuance of money is always tempting to any government. It always helps them achieve their aim to somehow secure resources, to get things from people by buying them with money they've created. It's a form of counterfeiting, a form of making false money. But all governments counterfeit now. It's legal, of course. It's perfectly consistent with the laws of each country, but it's, in an economic sense, it's counterfeiting. It's creating false money because it's creating money by just declaring the existence of new money. It comes from nowhere except fiat, decree. Okay. Well, finally, let me say that the Depression did not end during the 1930s. It continued. Once upon a time, if you looked in a history book in the United States, the historians would give Roosevelt credit for curing the Depression, for bringing the country out of the Depression. But he did not. He did not. Now, it is true that the economy improved after 1933 when Roosevelt took office. But 4 years later, in 1937, it dropped again before it had recovered fully. So the Depression of 1937-38 would be considered very serious, one of the most serious in American economic history, except that it occurred in the middle of an even more serious depression. And so people hardly notice it now. It's just sometimes called the depression within a depression. inside another one. And that meant that recovery was delayed further for another 2 years, perhaps. And even in 1940, the unemployment rate was still 10%. Historically, the unemployment rate was always around 5%. Sometimes a little more, sometimes less, but the long average was about 5%. But even after more than 10 years of depression, the unemployment rate in the United States was still 10%, and many people who were working at that time, several millions of persons, were working in government jobs created simply to give them something to do. They weren't legitimate jobs like those in the private sector. So the depression did not end. And when it persisted, Roosevelt changed his course somewhat after 1935. And he decided that although he had started out trying to cooperate with business interests, remember the National Industrial Recovery Act, the scheme to cartelize all the industries? Well, of course, the businessmen love that. That's what businessmen are always trying to do, is form little cartels or monopolies with one another to restrain competition and increase their profits. But normally, if they have no government assistance in this effort, competition comes back. It finds a way to express itself because someone can gain from cheating on the cartel. If the cartel creates a very high price, that means that there's a lot to be gained if I sell more of my product at that high price. But if I sell more, then supply is actually greater, and that high price is no longer consistent with supply and demand. So I will tend to drive those prices down to destroy the cartel agreement to restrict supply. Okay? And we see this again and again where cartels form. They contain the seeds of their own destruction unless they are supported by governments. Well, the NIRA, the Recovery Act, was government support for everybody's cartel. But then, of course, that was declared unconstitutional in 1935, so that whole scheme disappeared, except for some of its parts that were created by new law. But it was much less comprehensive after 1935. So Roosevelt, after 1935, changed his talk. He changed his rhetoric. The way he gave his speeches, he decided that he would blame businessmen. He would blame investors. He would say the depression is because of actions these businessmen are taking. They're selfish. They're greedy. They're not serving the public interest. They should be taxed more heavily. Roosevelt became a demagogue, a man on horseback, kind of ranting, not exactly like Adolf Hitler, but in that style of getting the people's emotions stirred up against the enemies in their midst, the enemies among them, these rich people, investors and businessmen. Well, of course, if you were an investor or some person with money and thinking about making investments, this created a very pessimistic atmosphere. And so because Roosevelt frightened so many investors from 1935 onward, not only with his talk, but also with some actual policies. In 1936 and 1937, taxes were raised, especially on corporations and on wealthy people. Taxes were put on corporations that retained their earnings and did not pay them out to shareholders where the government could tax the dividends. that meant that there was no escaping the tax man any longer for corporations. Many other changes were made in those new tax laws. They were clearly aimed at punishing wealthy people, punishing investors, punishing corporations. And they had many negative effects on the economy, especially negative effects on small companies that were just getting started, did not have the ability to borrow from banks so easily, and they relied on retained earnings as a source of funding for increasing their business and making it bigger and reinvesting the profits. But if those profits they did not pay out to shareholders were going to be taxed heavily, then it was much more difficult for them to use that source of funding for their own growth. So at the time when investment was still very depressed, remember it fell by almost 90% in the early years of the decade, and it never recovered. And when it was just starting to recover, Roosevelt became hostile to business and frightened investors so much that private investment never did recover. That's the main reason why the American Depression lasted so much longer than the Depression in other countries. So the Depression there was deeper and longer, even though the Depression was serious in many countries, especially Germany. It was most serious in the United States. So that is all I will be able to say about that, but this is a way of seeing in the solid line, the one that goes the highest during the bulge in the 1940s, that's the line showing gross domestic product. In real terms, these numbers are adjusted for inflation, and I've also put them in logarithms so that by doing this, I can take the slope of any line, any function, and the slope is a way of seeing the rate of growth. The steeper the slope, the greater the rate of growth of the variable that line is tracing. So what you see is that after 1933, gross domestic product recovers. But if you look at where the trend line was, and the trend is that dotted line at the very top that connects 1929 with 1948, because those were 2 years of full employment production in the United States. So that's what the economy was capable of doing. It was capable of moving along that dotted line at the top. That's its trend growth line for economic output potential. What you see is that the actual gross domestic product, even in 1941, had not returned to the trend line. Even then, the economy was producing below its potential. And throughout that decade, of course, it's below that trend line. It seems to rise above the trend line during the war, and I'll say more about that in a minute. That's an illusion. But you can see just from that chart exactly how the Depression never ended until the war. When the war came, the Depression actually continued, but it continued in a completely new form, a more deceptive form, because the unemployment disappeared, and it seemed as if recovery had come, but it hadn't really come. It was simply a great amount of government spending for war purposes that made the economy appear to be prosperous. If you look at those bars in my chart there, that is the private part, the non-government part of national product. And what you see is that it does not come back up to its trend line, its possible growth pattern, in the 1930s, of course, but it does not come during the war either. It's only after the war ends that private production comes back to its growth trend line. And we finally see a true recovery of the economy, not a spurious or illusory recovery. Okay. Well, let's think now about the war for the rest of my time today. I mentioned before that the resumption of warfare in 1939 in Europe looks very much to the historian like chapter 2 of the same book, in which World War I was chapter 1. Clearly, many Germans had been unhappy with the Versailles settlement, and anyone who paid attention to political events in Europe in the late 1930s knew that war was going to occur again. No one knew exactly when. And, of course, the diplomats and the politicians were always making frantic efforts to settle differences and to try to reach accommodation with the more aggressive powers. But it was quite clear that Germany could not be kept in a cage where the French and the British had tried to put it in 1919. And so it was just a matter of how it would break out of the cage. So, of course, war did begin again in 1939. And when it began, just as in 1914, most American people were extremely shocked, they were unhappy, and they wanted nothing to do with it. Because even though the Americans had become quite hysterical about the war during World War I, they got extremely hyper-patriotic and excited in 1917 and 1918, within a few years, almost all of them saw what a mistake it had been for America to enter the First World War. Not only had quite a large number of Americans been killed or wounded, but great amounts of American money had been spent. America had spent approximately $33 billion to fight World War I, which was equivalent to more than one-third of an entire year's gross domestic product. And they seemed to have nothing to show for it, whatever. What good had it done America to be part of World War I? And so they said to themselves, never again. Never again. We were fooled before. We will not be fooled a second time. So the desire to return to the traditional American policy, the policy of Washington and Jefferson, of remaining completely out of European conflicts, was very strongly held in the United States in 1939. And the next 2 years were extremely interesting ones, because the Roosevelt administration, unlike most of the American people, very much wanted America to join the war again. Roosevelt, like Wilson, had strong sympathies in favor of the British. Roosevelt was also a man extremely prejudiced against German people. He actually seems to have hated Germans for some reason. We can be amateur psychiatrists and try to understand why did he feel so much hatred toward Germans. It's not clear, but he did. He also disliked Japanese people. And that was important for America too. Because the next 2 years, from the fall of 1939 until the actual beginning of America's participation as a declared belligerent in December 1941, it was a great struggle in America between the pro-war and the anti-war groups. And just as before, during the First World War, the British and their propagandists were extremely active and extremely well embedded in the highest circles of American government, given cover, as it were, to operate freely and to influence American public opinion by spreading propaganda against the Germans and in favor of the British. And once again, the Americans were the poor, ignorant country cousins of the sophisticated Brits who led them around and told them lies, and those lies were believed by more and more people. Now, because the Roosevelt administration actually favored the British and the French before they surrendered, the administration made many actions to help the British. We were supposed to be neutral. Officially, we were neutral. But in fact, the government was never neutral. It always favored the French and the British, and the administration used its powers, sometimes even did things it had no real power to do. It acted unlawfully to give resources to the British to help them militarily in a variety of ways. In 1940, for example, the president transferred to the British a large number of American warships. Smaller ships called destroyers that are used mainly for anti-submarine warfare. These were older military vessels, but they were still useful because German submarines were a great menace to British shipping. And so it was very helpful to the British to get these American ships. The President of the United States had no authority to just hand over part of the U.S. Navy to a foreign power, but he did it anyhow. He began around the end of 1940 to authorize the transfer of large amounts of supplies, some munitions, and others just foodstuffs and raw materials that were useful to Great Britain or to France. And in March 1941, those arrangements were actually approved by Congress, and this was called the Lend-Lease Act. The Lend-Lease Act was a kind of a misleading name Roosevelt gave to what was actually foreign military assistance. There was no actual lending or leasing. Roosevelt told a story when he gave a speech that this is like giving your neighbor a water hose when his house is on fire because he needs it right now. There's an emergency. He needs to put out the fire. But when he's put out the fire, he'll give the hose back to you. You know, no harm done. You've lost nothing. It's lend-lease. We're lending to the British, and they will repay us. But, of course, they never repaid us. None of the people we gave military supplies to during the war, the French, the British, the Russians, no one ever repaid us. This was just America's way of participating in the war before the time war had been declared and American soldiers had been sent to the battlefields. So, in that way, and many others, especially in planning between American military and British military, in making up plans for cooperation, in sharing information, in the Atlantic, the Americans made patrols And when they saw British U-boats from airplanes or identified their presence from their ships, they would transmit that information to the British Navy, and it would then go and try to destroy the German U-boats. So America was actually at war, and more at war during 1941. But officially, it was not at war. This was all, to some extent, kept undercover. It was Roosevelt could not just come out and admit to the public everything he was doing, because most of the public, even at the end of 1941, or near the end, wanted to remain out of the war. More than 80% of Americans in the polls that were taken said, you know, we should stay out of the war. So what Roosevelt needed in order to finally get the public to approve what he wanted was some great provocation, some great event that would cause people to think that now they were just defending themselves, and they would gladly cooperate in making war. Well, he got that, but he got it, as historians say, through the back door. No matter how hard the Americans provoked the Germans in the North Atlantic, the Germans would not take the bait. They were not stupid. They knew what Roosevelt was trying to do, and so they knew not to make any great attack. Now, it's true, the U-boats would shoot back when the Americans and the British attacked them, but except in direct self-defense, the Germans were very careful, very cautious. They certainly did not want to provoke America to enter the war if they could keep it out. So they were careful. They refused to be tricked by Roosevelt. But in 1940 and 41, Roosevelt began to take a series of measures against Japan. Japan was at war with China, and had been at war with China since 1937. Some Americans, since the beginning of the 20th century, had somehow become attached to China and the Chinese, and thought of them as somehow people that were friendlier, the people we should do more to help and protect, whereas the Japanese never had a good reputation in America, with the higher powers, at least. In fact, most people despised the Japanese, and they were very badly treated when they came here as immigrants. But anyhow, the American government was very partial to the Chinese, and so it was always trying to open up China so that American businessmen could operate there, and British businessmen and French businessmen and other Western businesses could go there and operate freely on terms at least as good as those the Japanese enjoyed. Now, the Japanese, of course, they were trying to extend their domination of East Asia. They were building what they called the Greater East Asia Co-Prosperity Sphere. That was their propaganda for, we'll just be one big happy family of Asians, all cooperating against the Europeans who've come in here as colonialists and imperialists and have taken advantage of all of us. So let's kick out the white man. Let's join forces as Asians. And that message actually had quite a bit of appeal to many other Asians. Not to the Chinese, who are the ancient enemies of the Japanese, but in Southeast Asia, the Japanese were sometimes welcomed, because when they came, the Dutch were kicked out, the English were kicked out. Good. So the Japanese were building their own empire. And if Americans had been realistic, they would have said, this is none of our business. You know, powers are built here and there in the world. It doesn't affect us. Because it really didn't. There was a very little effect. Any trade between the United States and China was sure to be smaller than the trade between the United States and Japan. Japan was already a fairly advanced economic nation by 1940. And the United States had considerable trade with Japan. And it was that trade that Roosevelt used to put pressure on Japan. He began to put restrictions on trade. He restricted what Americans could sell to the Japanese, restricting petroleum products, restricting iron and steel, restricting all kinds of commodities that could be used for military purposes directly, such as aircraft engines or certain metals. Well, the Japanese were not stupid. They knew what was being done to them. But this was a very serious thing because Japan is a country almost without any natural resources. Its development had depended entirely on its importation of petroleum and petroleum products. It has no oil, iron and steel. It has no iron ore deposits, coal, other metals that are important in industry. The Japanese had to import these things from other parts of the world in order to operate a modern economy. And in return, they specialized in certain manufactured goods. In the beginning, things like cotton textiles that they could produce with comparatively low cost and export to other countries to pay for their imports. And Japan had done very well by entering into the International Division of Labor. But if its raw materials were cut off, then it really could not survive as a modern country. And every 2 or 3 months, the American government put a new restriction on. There were two sources of oil for Japan that were most important. One was the United States, and the other was what is now Indonesia. At that time, the Dutch East Indies. So the United States, besides restricting its own exports to Japan, entered into agreements with the British and the Dutch. The Dutch, you know, finally had not a real government because the Germans had occupied them and they had a kind of residual colonial government in exile, but it still controlled the Dutch East Indies. And so the Americans and the Dutch and the British joined forces to all agree that they would together restrict products sent to Japan. So in the year 1941, Japan was being strangled more and more so that it could see that within another year, 2 years at most, it would have used all of its reserves of raw materials and it would be unable to operate its modern economy, which meant, of course, it would be unable to operate its modern armed forces. It could not any longer fight effectively a war in China. It would have to withdraw, and it would have to suffer impoverishment because of these restrictions. So the Japanese were being squeezed, and if one goes and reads the records of the Japanese deliberations, which we can do now because these are available to historians, we see them making very rational calculations. What can we do? They were restricted, as every political system is, by counter forces within it. The military was very strong in Japanese politics at that time, so the Japanese could never simply say, well, let's just do as the Americans want, withdraw all of our forces from China, admit defeat, you know, after years and years of fighting with considerable success against the Chinese and the establishment of control over large areas of China containing very valuable raw materials. Let's just give up. Let's lose face. Okay? Let's suffer humiliation. The worst thing for a Japanese, lose face. And that way, we can continue to trade with the Americans and with the European colonies in Southeast Asia and obtain the raw materials we need. That was not a solution the Japanese government could make. The military would not withdraw. It would not lose face. It would not admit defeat. So something else had to happen. And the only thing left seemed to be they had to attack America and the European powers. They had to take control of large areas of Asia, especially the Dutch East Indies, where they could get the raw materials they needed. And they had to establish a perimeter to defend themselves in the Pacific with their very good navy, so that the Americans would decide this was really not worthwhile. You know, it's too costly to try to dominate the Japanese policymaking, so we'll just settle with them. Okay? They knew from the beginning that if the Americans would not settle, and they simply struck back and insisted on total defeat of the Japanese, that they would succeed. That America was much too powerful, much too large an economy for Japan to defeat. But the Japanese weren't seeking to defeat it, just as during the war between the states and in America, the Confederacy was not seeking to defeat the North, only to withdraw and be left alone. The Japanese only wanted the Europeans to get out of Asia and leave them alone, and they thought they could hold their area against the Westerners long enough to reach a settlement that would improve their situation. They were mistaken, we know now. But what they did as the opening shot of this policy was to attack on a wide front. One attack was against the U.S. Navy at Hawaii, at Pearl Harbor. That succeeded in destroying or damaging heavily a large part of the U.S. Pacific Fleet, which the Americans had stupidly concentrated at Pearl Harbor, so that it was very easy to attack very successfully. There are many targets all in the same place with weak defenses. And at the same time, they attacked many islands in the Pacific and took control of them. They attacked Southeast Asia in different places. And they very quickly spread their military forces over areas extending for many thousands of kilometers from Japan to the southwest, and out to the east into the Pacific. So this attack on Pearl Harbor for the average American seemed like a total surprise. He didn't know anything about Roosevelt's economic restrictions on the Japanese. This was not front page news. This is like something only diplomats and a few people who followed this kind of news knew about. The average American thought, you know, here we are doing nothing, minding our business, and the Japanese attack us completely viciously. So Americans were completely angry about this attack, and almost 100% of them, even though they might have been completely against entering the war before, now they were completely in favor of war. Let's go to war. Let's take our revenge on those Japanese. And because the Japanese were allied with the Germans, Hitler finally decided after the Japanese attack that he would simply make the reality official, and he declared war on the United States, and the United States in return declared war on Germany. And so from that point, December 1941, the United States was an open, declared, active belligerent. Now, even though quite a lot of effort had been made before that to build up the American armed forces. The American army had been increased from less than 200,000 men to nearly 2 million men. That was a good beginning, but 2 million was not going to make much of an impact on World War II, especially if the Americans were going to fight on two fronts, in Europe and in the Pacific. So the Americans needed to build up their military economy much more to be an effective force. And as soon as Pearl Harbor took place, they started to do that. And what they accomplished in the next 4 years was really quite amazing. I don't think they could do it now. There's too much paperwork and too much bureaucracy now to get anything done quickly. But in those days, it was still possible to accomplish great things in a hurry. And so they were in a great hurry. The Congress gave great powers to the president to control the economy in almost every way. And he used those powers to transfer resources from civilian uses to military uses quite quickly. Now, the first thing that had to be done was really to build up the infrastructure, the basis for supporting a military force of large size. Because if you're going to have millions and millions of men in the Army and Navy, you have to have a lot of factories producing equipment for them, ammunition for them. You have to have a lot of bases where they can live and train. You have to have a lot of transportation to take them wherever they need to be to fight the war. So many things have to be created by industry in order to make modern armies effective. Certainly in the 1940s, this was the great industrial war. That's why, in the end, the Americans were decisive, because America was the great economy. It was the biggest one by far in the world, and it could outproduce everybody. All Americans who fought in Europe admitted that the Germans were superior fighters in many ways. They were better trained. Their military equipment was better. They had more experience. Americans had a lot of trouble after D-Day invasion, when these troops that had seen no battle or very little battle before came against the German Wehrmacht that had been fighting for 4 or 5 years. It was extremely difficult. They were hard-pressed, but they had the great advantage. They could just overwhelm the enemy with mass. And by that time, the Germans had trouble getting fuel, making enough fuel to keep their aircraft operating. But the Americans could produce fuel without limit for their airplanes. They could send thousands of airplanes on one raid, dropping bombs over Europe. And so just the economic power of America would be decisive eventually, even if they were not very good at strictly military operations, which, you know, often they were not, to be honest. Now, this from an economic point of view, all of this government spending for arms and to build up the infrastructure of war raw materials production created what seemed to be an economic boom. And if you look at my top line there, measuring real gross domestic product, it looks as if, especially from 1941 on, there's an enormous rate of growth. There's no rate of growth like that before. And not only did the economy get back up to its full production trend line, it seems to go far above it. And as economists, someone should have always stopped and said, how is this possible? How can an economy produce more than its full capacity? But they didn't think very hard about it, and for decades, most American economists And even today, most American economists believe that the figures displayed in that line are meaningful. They're good ones. But they're not good ones, because what we're measuring here in gross domestic product is the production of goods and services valued at market prices. That's how we add products that are physically not commensurable. If we add apples and oranges, we have no common unit, but if we take the value of apples produced and the value of oranges produced, then we can add their monetary values. So when we compute gross domestic product, we take the physical units produced of each good and we weight it, we multiply it by its market price, because market price tells us the value that consumers place on one more unit of that good in the market at the time and the conditions that we face. Now, if economic conditions were different, then prices might be different and values might be different for apples and oranges. Now, what happens if the product is not a real market product with its price determined by supply and demand, but its price is arbitrary? It's like the price that the Russians put on goods under the central planning. It's not determined by the free choices of consumers and the free choices of suppliers. It's the result of a command. That's what we're seeing here. Because the government took such control of the economy, these war products are not normal products. They have no market prices, really. It's true the government pays for them. If General Motors produces a military tank, the government gives General Motors some money and takes away the tank. But we have to stop and ask, well, how did they decide on what price to pay? After all, there's no market here. The government has simply told General Motors, we want some tanks, you produce them, and this is the amount of money we'll give you for each one. There's no operation of economic forces here at all. These prices are entirely the product of bureaucratic negotiation. Now, of course, General Motors wanted to get as much money as possible when it sold its products to the government. But in wartime conditions, it really had very little to say. If the government didn't want to pay more, it didn't have to, because it could say, this is as much as we'll pay, and you must accept it, because under the laws that had been created during the war, giving powers to the government to set prices for all the goods it took for war purposes, you were guilty of a crime if you didn't cooperate and obey the government's decisions. So, of course, the industrialists, the factory owners, they did the best they could when they negotiated with the government military buyers, but there was not much they could do. There was only one buyer, and it had legal force over them. So these prices are not real prices. They're arbitrary prices. They don't have any meaning. They're not like the price of a glass of beer. If it's if it's 10 crowns, then we know 10 crowns is about what the people in the market buying beer consider a value they're willing to pay for one more glass of beer. But we don't know anything about how much consumers valued another military tank produced by General Motors, because consumers were not asked. They simply had to pay taxes when the government ordered them to pay taxes, and then the government used that money to make purchases. There's no consumer evaluation, no normal judgment about trade-offs that consumers make whenever they make any purchase. So these prices are arbitrary. It really was not the case that the economy produced more than it was capable of producing. It did not do the impossible. It simply produced a lot of guns and ammunition and other military products. that war boom is a statistical illusion. Now, it is true, of course, that unemployment disappeared. And that is the main reason why people at the time thought that there was prosperity during the war. America had the great advantage over the other warring powers that the war never really came to our homeland. And the closest the war really came was when Japanese U-boats came to the coast and they would sink merchant ships, especially in 1942. They sank many, many merchant ships carrying oil from Texas and Louisiana to the Northeast, where most of the industry is located. But other than that, and some very, very, very minor Japanese attempts to explode little bombs or to fire a few shells at the coast of California, we did not have to experience destruction in our cities. So if you were an American working at home, this seemed like a pretty good time. In some ways, you had a job. Anybody who wanted a job could be hired like that, because labor was very scarce. The unemployment rate fell so low, it's measured as 1%. And that was entirely made up of people moving from one job to a better one. There was no real unemployment in 1943, 44, 45. Jobs were so easy to get that old people who had retired decided they would come back and work some more. Young people who would have been in school decided they would leave school and get a job. Women who had worked at home, taking care of children or taking care of their homes, decided they would go into the paid labor force and work in a factory or in an office. Much of the employment by the government was in keeping records. This was a great typewriter war. Constantly making records of everything. It's a paradise for historians because we can get information on everything that was done. Very careful, detailed records all typed up on those bad quality typewriters. Often now in bad quality photocopies, but still good records. It's not like what we have for earlier times. Very full records. So many women could go work as secretaries or typists working for the Army or the Navy. That was a good job for young women at the time. So there's no unemployment, it's true. But it's not that the unemployment has disappeared because the war brought the economy out of the Depression. Look what happens to private output. The black bars in my graph. After 1941, it actually falls. And it remains below the 1941 level until 1945, when it's just back, because the war ended about the middle of 1945 and people began to produce private goods again. But only in 1946 do you see the real recovery of the private economy. This is the production of things that really improve people's standard of living. It's clothing, you know, it's food, it's appliances for homes, it's new houses. During the war, there was almost no construction at all of any civilian buildings. No business buildings, unless they were for war production. No houses for people to live in. Housing was very scarce in all the places where there was much war production. Workers would go there to work, but the only place to live was in the home of someone who already lived there. So housing became crowded. People had to live perhaps far away from their workplace and spend a lot of time getting to work. That was hard because There was rationing of many consumer goods, including gasoline. So you couldn't buy all the gasoline you wanted. You could buy only a few gallons each week. And you had to have ration coupons besides money to get the gasoline or other ration products. So it was hard to commute to work from far away. Tires for automobiles were rationed. They were very scarce in the war. And so if you used your car very much, the tires would wear out. In those days, the quality of the tires was poor, so the tires would wear out much quicker than they do now. But you could not replace them because they were almost impossible to purchase. I have here a ration book. These ration books were issued each month to every person, even babies. Every human being was issued a ration book each month. The one I'm holding here was issued to a girl 2 years old. And it has her name, and it had people's address. And just as the government had discovered the best way to have a draft is with local civilian boards, as they did in World War I. They did that again in World War II. They had discovered this worked well. So they established thousands of draft boards. And in World War II, they drafted 10 million people, men, all men. And that meant that of all the people who served in the armed forces at any time during the war, 16 million altogether, 10 million were drafted, and many of those who voluntarily enlisted did so only because they feared the draft. If you waited and you were drafted, there was a much better chance you would be in a bad place in the armed forces. You would more likely be in the infantry with a higher chance of death, very bad living conditions. But if you joined the Navy, at least you could be clean. If you joined the Air Force, which was still part of the Army in those days, but it was a little bit separate, you could join the Army Air Corps, and then you wouldn't have to live outside in the dirt and the bad weather, and you could be warm in the winter. So men, instead of waiting to be drafted, they would join the Navy or the Air Corps in hopes that they would get a better, less dangerous job. Eventually, the government stopped accepting voluntary enlistments because they didn't like this system. It left the Army with the worst quality men. And so they began in the last couple of years of the war to draft everybody and then assign the draftees to each of the different military services. But just as the draft boards were decentralized, the ration boards were everywhere. There were, I think, about 8,000 ration boards. So usually the housewife would go down once a month to the ration office, get books of stamps, however many people were entitled to. And it depended somewhat on who you were. If you were a religious minister, you got extra gasoline. If you were a doctor, you got as much gasoline as you wanted, because in those days doctors would go to visit people in their homes when they were sick, and government officials, they got all the gasoline they wanted. Now, most of all the military people didn't have this. This was just for civilians. The military got whatever it wanted, and it always got first choice. If the military wanted to use the train to move troops, then civilians were just kept away. And the train was completely filled up with Army troops. I was born during the war, so I don't have any memory of the warriors themselves. But immediately after the war, when I was a little boy, I can still remember seeing some of these trains completely filled up with Army soldiers. They're still being let out of the Army. It took more than a year, almost 2 years, to draw down the large army and to bring them back to the United States, because at the end of the war, they were all over the world. And there were not enough ships available to transport millions and millions of men quickly back to the United States. So Americans became very unhappy when they were stuck in the Pacific in some dreadful little island or some horrible place that they didn't want to be. They wanted to be home. The war was over, and they couldn't understand why they were still sitting out there in a bad place, left to rot, or it seemed that way. There were mutinies. There were uprisings of soldiers in some places after the war was over because they weren't being brought home quick enough. But rationing applied to not every good, but to many civilian goods. Gasoline, tires, clothing, many food items, canned foods, to sugar, meat, fats, oils. Quite a list. Probably about 100 major consumer items that almost everybody used. Now, the reason they had to do this is that when the military began to take more and more products and more industrial capacity for its own use, that meant that the ability to supply civilian goods was reduced. And so the prices began to rise. When the supply of civilian goods fell, with demand the same or even greater, because people were now earning money from war production, prices started to rise very quickly in 1941. Remember, prices had been almost steady from 1934 on. They'd fallen in the early 30s, they'd come up a little in 1934, and then they hardly moved up into 1940. But when the government began its big war economy, prices began to rise for consumers' goods. And the government didn't like that, because it knew that if prices got very high, that meant that more money would be needed, because unless workers received higher wages, they would find that their earnings were smaller and smaller in purchasing value, and the government did not want to pay more money wages, because then it had to somehow get more funds from somehow, more taxes. And taxes were already being raised every year, raised to tremendous levels. Never before had most Americans paid income tax. But during World War II, taxes were raised so much, and even ordinary people had to pay taxes. People that earned very relatively low incomes had to pay income tax, and quite a bit of income tax also. Not 4%, not 7%, but the lowest rate during the war was 23%. So if you made more than $4,000, and then the next dollar you made, you owed 23 cents to the federal government. So this was something the American working class had never had to put up with before. But even with all these higher taxes, the government was spending so much money, 10 times more than it spent on World War I. Okay? World War I cost $33 billion. World War II cost the government more than $300 billion. So it needed to get enormous amounts of money, and even with the high taxes, it was able to provide only about 40% of the money it needed to spend, and it got the rest by borrowing. Now, just as before, it made that borrowing easier by its monetary policy, using the Federal Reserve System to create new money through the banking system and even directly in this case. So I see I've run over time, so let's stop for now.